Hey, Dr. Anderson, can you tell us a little bit as we start the conversation as to what led you to focus on the psychosocial health of Black youth and their families?
Sure. Well, thanks again so much for having me as well. So to know me is to know who I am and where I'm from. It's to know that I am born in, Now you got me forgetting how I introduce myself. Born in, raised for, and returned to Detroit. That's how I think about myself. So Detroit as this urban center is not just a normal metropolis. It's a place that has the highest percentage of Black people in the United States. So it's a way of thinking about growing up, seeing some issues that were pursuant to Black folks and me wondering what I could do about that. And I think if you're a smart kid in these urban places, they say, oh, you should be a doctor, you should be a lawyer. And I always knew that those options were around. But I started thinking a bit more concretely about some of the issues that I saw in the surrounding neighborhoods and in my community to say, what would it be like if we didn't need a doctor to repair some of the struggles that we potentially saw on the body? What if we didn't need a lawyer to defend someone after a crime was committed? What if we could do more preventative work? So the work that I started thinking about was just looking proximally around me. What's going on around me? What is something that's impacting the people who I see? And what are some of the preventative strategies that we haven't utilized? And that led me to psychology and this beautiful way of thinking about the mental health and well-being. How can we engage in approaches that would actually thwart some of these outcomes that people say smart kids like me should look at as a profession? So that's how I got into this work.
I really like a little bit more about your personal, about your personal experiences about Detroit. Now, recently I just begun to travel there on a regular basis. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about your experiences and kind of, let us know what it was like for you.
Yeah. So, and Aaron, I'm excited to hear what you have to share too, but, I think by and large, it's a normal experience where you're a kid and you're exploring what's around you. You're playing with whoever's around you. You're excited about the world and you're growing autonomy. And at the same time, all of these elements that go into what your neighborhood looks like, right? So as an example, where I would go to get fresh food would be a corner store or a gas station and not a grocery store. We didn't have grocery stores close to us. And that became an issue when food deserts became more popular, but that wasn't a term that we knew growing up. It was just like, you get your bag of chips or you get, you know, something that's wrapped up from the store around you and that's your food. Right. Or there were plenty of fast food restaurants. So on the corners by me, there was a Burger King, a KFC, a Subway, a Little Caesar. So that was every single fast food restaurant nearby. But fresh food was not something that we brought into the house. And I actually remember going to grad school and someone teasing me about this when I was eating Cheez-Its, which for me was a healthy snack because it wasn't deep fried. It wasn't, you know, something that that I thought was bad for my health. They were like, well, you're eating Cheez-Its. That's a lot of saturated fat and whatever. And I was like, this for us is healthy, right? And it took me until grad school, it took me until now coming back to Detroit where I'm realizing how some of those things that I grew up with weren't quote normal for other people, right? And how they may have had large plots of land where these kiddos could go run around and have that space. I had concrete, right? Or if they had, again, that fresh grocery store relative to what I had around me of prepared and prepackaged foods, that was not normal for us. So I say that, Kevin, because I think even some of the experiences that I had where something may have seemed normal for me, and I even hesitate saying some of them because I think folks would pathologize, but I'll give a quick example. We had a issue on our block where one of our neighbors experienced domestic violence. And the way that our block responded to that was that a gang that was on our block said, like, this man isn't welcome back here, and posted up on the street. Like, you could see them being visible and not letting that person come back down the street, which for some people may sound really problematic and like, oh, there's gangs, but for me, understanding that was one of the protective mechanisms that were in place for our neighborhood and for that neighbor so that she would not face that again. That was something that I learned was a strategy. And I'll quickly just end that by saying some of the things that we do in psychology, in mental health, where we pathologize and we point a finger at some of these things in our communities, if there's not a proper understanding of why they even came to be and how to integrate some of those strategies into the work that we're doing, then we're really missing how some children made it out of these communities alive and well.
No, I hear you. It sounds like, you know, adaptiveness, right? Just very nature. Sure. We have to fill the gap, whatever we need. It's how we act as humans.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
No, I think it's, you know, everything that you bring up is so interesting, and to hear it from someone who has that lived experience. And could you talk a little bit about how racial stress and trauma has really become a public health issue?
Yeah, I'll start by saying that it is important to have the American Public Health Association or the American Psychological Association acknowledging racism as these issues, right, within as a public health crisis or as a stressor for psychological well-being. It's important to acknowledge that these things are around. It's something that I always think about with respect to perceived versus received, and I'll say a bit about what the heck that means. So if you study discrimination, you may see that there is this perceived construct that goes along with it. So a lot of the measures might ask about perceived discrimination, which I think is a slap in the face to people who experience it and have received this discriminatory or this racist way of being. And sometimes you can't even measure it, right? So I just talked about what my neighborhood looked like growing up, not having fresh air, fresh food, places to play. So that built environment was not something that I would have put my finger on as a five-year-old and said that was racist, but it was. That school that had asbestos, which I went to every day, I didn't know that was a function of racism, but it was. My inability to start some of my classes at the University of Michigan on the same level as some of my classmates who were just one district over, those are things that I learned in time were functions of racism, but couldn't put my finger on. So again, even us saying this idea of perceived is making it feel like for the people who have experienced this or received that this ongoing racial onslaught on their minds and on their bodies makes us feel like something isn't right with us, that we're imagining things. So I know you didn't ask that at all, Aaron, but I think it's really important to say that at the beginning, because there has never not been a time where racism should have led to stress and trauma. So I'm saying that because if people are just now saying, wow, in 2021, we're just now putting the label on this, we're just now comfortable making it a state or nationwide mandate that we're considering this to be a stressor or a traumatic event, there has then, to me, been a disbelief that could have been stressful or traumatic before this date, and that there wasn't evidence somehow to support or suggest that these things were chipping away at the mental health and well-being of not only Black people, but everyone. And that is, for me, the last point on this, which is, you know, so many people turn to folk of color and say, how is racism and discrimination impacting them? But study after study shows what would happen to us all. We would be better people writ large. We would have a better society if we did not operate from a sense of racial oppression and intolerance. There would be growth for everyone. We'd be healthier. We'd be wealthier. We'd be all of these things together. Yet there's a fear that by acknowledging it or by trying to fix it, people may lose power, people may lose their standing in society. And I think that's why we didn't acknowledge it for so long, because there was a fear around what would happen to my slice of the pie if we tried to make traction on that. So Aaron, I went all over the place with that, but I hope that addressed some of your question.
It sure did. Can you all